Verse 11, it says, Jesus continued. It says, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. And so he divided his property between them. And not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he came to his senses, he said, How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. Let's begin with prayer. Father, I ask that you would open our eyes and our ears, open our hearts, that we might have an understanding, Lord, of not only what the story says, Lord, but what it means to us in particular. That every one of us has come here tonight with our own issues, our own challenges, our own pains and sorrows, Lord, our defeats and discouragements, and our own questionings. God, I pray that your Spirit would just meet us in this place and do a profound work in our lives, that you might be glorified through us as your servants. We ask you for this grace, Lord, in Jesus' precious name. Amen. You may be seated. Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, that in chapter 15, we're given three different stories by Jesus, each seeking to illustrate the concept of compassion, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and now the story of the lost son, or maybe more appropriately, the lost sons. Because as you will see when we get to the end of this series, that really it's not just the younger son who has serious spiritual problems. Also, we'll find that the older son has a different set of problems, but just as important. In a way, they represent the two extremes that God saw in the behaviors of the people of his own day. On the one hand, we see the self-indulgence of sinfulness, obvious transgression against the law of God. Anybody could pick it out in the dark and say, that shouldn't be. But on the other extreme is a behavior that oftentimes we miss because we think, well, this is the good guy who's keeping the rules. And yet the critical issue, Jesus said, was even though people might draw near to him with their lips, what he was really concerned about was where their heart was at. And his condemnation of his own generation is just that. You say all the right things, but I don't look at externals. I look at internal issues. And when I look at the secret place of your heart, in other words, when I look at that realm of the soul that's made up of the mind, the emotions, and the will, I know when I look at your mind that your mind is not focused upon me. And I know that when I look at the things that you love and that you emotionally feel strong about, it's not about me, it's about something else. And therefore, I understand why what you have determined to do by the volition of your own will, your own choices, always ends up being something that is not really within the circle of my desire, my heart, and my will, and my design for your life. Well, in the story that's often referred to as the prodigal son, we have these three main characters. The first we just read about, the passionate son, I call him. He's a young man who allowed himself to be driven by the passions of his own inner man. In other words, if the soul is combined of these three entities, the mind, the will, and the emotions, he's one who allowed his emotions to govern over his mind. Then we'll see, secondly, there's his father, who is the emblematic image of compassion, the compassionate father. And then lastly, we'll see the compassionless son, the compassionless older brother. Now, why does this story refer to as the prodigal son? Well, some of you know that's kind of a King Jamesianism. We don't use the word prodigal much. But the word prodigal literally means somebody who wastes precious resources, someone who is recklessly wasteful and extravagantly wasteful. They throw away important things. And in a way, this is really somewhat of a misnomer, I think, because the real issue with this son wasn't about the fact that he wasted his portion of the inheritance. At least that isn't what you really see if you're looking at it from God's perspective. Because God is not concerned about money. I know that may shock some of you. But God really isn't concerned about money. Now, some of you are convinced of that because you have none. And you're convinced that as you pray and ask God for some and you don't get some, you think God must not care about money. But the point is that God doesn't care about money. That sometimes we think that money, as Solomon said, is the answer to everything. But what God is more concerned about is the whole disposition of my heart. Where am I in my heart in relationship to God? And God will use money both by giving it in abundance or by taking it completely away, all to test and prove the heart of a man, to see where a man or a woman is in relationship to God. And so one of the things we see in this story, and we'll explore further as we get into it the next few weeks, is that the father is willing to allow himself to be robbed, if you will, by an irresponsible son because he is more concerned than restoring his son to a place of right relationship with God than he is in retaining material wealth. And I tell you, those kind of situations can be the most challenging for us when God asks us to put our material resources at risk out of obedience to his purposes and his will. Boy, that becomes a tough test. And it says volumes about this father. But we'll get into that further on. But what we find is there is an extravagance in this story. And it's an extravagance not in wasting of money, but an extravagance of God's love manifested in this over-the-top manifestation of compassion to a child who is wholly undeserving of any of the kindness that he receives. Remember when we talked about the lost shepherd and the lost coin. How that the shepherd who leaves the 99 forsakes that which is secure, the profit of the shepherd's work. He leaves that in risk that he might go find that one that is missing. And even though from a naturalistic point of view, from a rational point of view, if you will, somebody would say, that's an extravagant risk, that's a wasteful way about doing something. But in a sense, God was simply saying, you have to understand how vitally important the one is to me. In the same way, the woman who went and lost the coin and then did all of these things to find the coin, and when she finds it, she throws a party which probably consumed the entire worth of the coin that she found. And we look and say, what is wrong with this woman that she is so wasteful? And yet Jesus, as I said, always used parables to scandalize his listeners so that they would step back and say, what in the world are you talking about? And what he was trying to illustrate is this concept of the extravagance of God's love for mankind. That when you realize that God was willing to become a man and pass through the issues of this world and deal with all the stuff that you and I have to deal with, and in the end to die on the cross, innocent but blamed for everything that the world had ever done, to die in our place unjustly, the just dying for the unjust, and all the rest of that. And if we step back and look at it, we should suddenly recognize this is an extravagance. This is almost, if it were a human perspective, we'd say there is a madness in what he is doing. Even Paul said, scarcely will a man die for a righteous man. No man would die for an unrighteous man. And yet that's exactly what God did in becoming a man. The righteous laying down his life for the unrighteous. And the only motivation that we can come up with, the only explanation we can derive to, is that God is driven by a compassion for you and me that surpasses human understanding. That if I try to understand the compassion that God has for me, my mind will go on tilt because I just can't get to that extreme of reality. And it's important for us to understand that. It's important, first of all, for me to understand that if I'm going to see myself correctly in the light of my relationship with God. Because many Christians are heavily burdened on a daily basis because they believe God is looking at them with a very strained and strenuous view. It's almost like there's a stringency to God that he's looking at you through a pee hole, you know, and all he can, that because that's all he can stand to look at any one time. You know how it is when you watch a really scary movie, at least true of me, when it gets really scary and you know, you can just tell by the music that it's going to get to that moment where something's going to pop out and make you wet your pants. You know those kind of moments? And I, even here I am, 58 years of age, and I'm still doing this. It's almost like it's just too much to look at. And sometimes we think that when God looks at humanity, it's just kind of like he's got to kind of hold his hands over his eyes and kind of look at you real quick because you're just too much to look at. And we think that's the view of God because as we recognize how inadequate and how undeserving and how unworthy we are, and we see all of our failings and all the flaws that are inherent to who we are, and we're way past that point in our Christian experience where we thought we could clean ourselves up and look real good. And we realize that you can't buff out what you got wrong with you. And then suddenly to understand that God still loves you and has compassion upon you is an amazing thing. It's kind of like when my youngest son and his wife moved to California, they left us a gift, their dog. This is the fourth or fifth dog we've inherited from our children. Every time they move, they give us a new gift. And this one is a real charmer. She's a real charmer. She's a miniature chihuahua with a gimp leg. It's got a crippled leg because they got her at a discount. And she has one snaggle tooth that hangs out the side. I mean, this dog is a candidate for the ugly dog contest. I mean, if you've seen the dog, just go, okay. And it's a friendly dog. When it sees you, it just attacks you. You know, just anybody's a stranger, barks and howls and attacks. And just, it's just, there's nothing really, really about this dog other than the fact that my wife and I have actually developed a tremendous affection for this dog, believe it or not, because this dog loves us. I mean, and the reason that she loves us is because my wife has bestowed a great deal of love upon this child. And I've restrained from kicking it across the room. So, you know, there's this dynamic where so every time I suggest that maybe there's a home someplace that would love a little puppy like this, you know, it's just kind of, it's usually me who has to think about looking for a new home every time I bring that up. But, you know, there's something about that kind of relationship when you look at this creature that, you know, you'd like to say it's got a face that only a mother could love and the mom's lying. You know, you just kind of look at this dog and you realize that there's the thing that's attractive is the response that it has in being loved. And sometimes I wonder if God's response to us and what he finds attractive in us is when we respond to the fact that he loves us. Because he makes such an effort in his word. He makes such an effort by the moving and the working of his spirit in your life to convince you that he does love you and that he values you and he desires your fellowship and he wants to be with you. You know, most of us know more rejection than we do acceptance in our life. We know more criticism than we do building up and encouragement. And so it builds in us kind of a self-view that we, for the most part, try to keep hidden from the rest of the world because we want to pretend to the rest of the world that we are irresistibly attractive and therefore they should like us. But deep down inside, we're really terrified that they're going to find out what everybody else who knows us well knows, that we have some very unlovely aspects of our personality and they're going to reject us. And sometimes we approach God with that same heart. We think that we have to kind of prove to God through our efforts and through our service and through our sacrifice and through our disciplines that we're deserving objects of his love, that we don't have a gimp leg, we don't have a snaggle tooth that hangs out there, and we don't have an irritating bark. We try to pretend that these things aren't who we are. And yet somehow we can't help becoming what we are. And as soon as we're manifest for who we are, what do we conclude? God must not love me. How could God love someone like me? Because look what I just did. Look what I just did. I know better than to do that, and I know that's sin, but I just did that. I'm so ashamed of myself. Oh, God must be so disappointed in me. I've really let God down. Like he's surprised. That's one thing that struck me one day when I just felt like I was falling so short of the Lord, and the Lord just simply said, you don't think I knew you were going to do this before time and eternity? I know everything. I knew this from before the founding of time, and so it's no surprise to me and what I did, because I knew this was going to happen at this moment in your life. You know what I've done? I've gone before and made provision through the death of my son to cleanse and to wash you from all of your unrighteousness, and all you need to do is confess it, and I'll forgive you. See, so many of us see ourselves as being the object of God's unlovingness. And yet the very truth of the matter is that God loves you at your worst. God loves you at your worst. Now, he doesn't want you to stay there, because God knows more than anything else that your joy is found in walking and living in the truth. There's no joy in sin. So that when people have this idea, well, if you minister the grace of God to people and tell them that he loves you and he's compassionate, then that'll give them excuses to go out and sin even more. Just the opposite is true. Just the opposite is true. That when you experience the loving grace of God and his compassion, you realize that you don't have to be that person. Why did you make the choice you made? Because you thought somehow by doing that, you would find love. You'd find acceptance. You'd find the pleasure that we're often willing to take in exchange for joy. But when we become, as Paul said, become rooted and grounded in the love of God. You know, Paul said to the Ephesians, that's my prayer for you. That you become rooted and grounded in God's love for you. That's the thing that holds you in your faith. That you know that God loves you, and there's no question in your mind of the depth of his love. He says, I want you to know the height, the width, the length, and the depth of what? His love for you. When you begin to give yourself permission to think in those terms, that when God looks at me, as God views you right now, his heart is filled with love for you. And when he sees you struggling, his heart feels compassion for you. Remember we talked about what the word compassion means? It means to suffer alongside. Not to be empathetic or sympathetic or to pity. You can do all those things at a safe distance and never get involved, but God is up close and personal. He comes into the midst of your deepest, darkest moments, your greatest failures. And if you look for him, you'll sense his gracious arms around you, saying, I'm walking through this with you. That's why these stories are here in the Bible. And that's why it is important for us to spend the time to really try to understand them. But to understand the extravagance of God's compassion in this story, we have to begin at the very beginning, where we find that the younger son does something to his father that in a Middle Eastern perspective is inconceivable, incomprehensible. That the son says to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. Now, why is this such an incomprehensible thing to ask? Because, first of all, under the rules of inheritance, and this was something we find both in the biblical record, but also in Middle Eastern culture as a whole. But in Deuteronomy 21, verses 15 through 17, it essentially says that the firstborn son in a family is always the recipient of a double share of the inheritance. The firstborn, in other words, this man had two sons, we're told, and so the man would divide his property into three parts. Two of them would be given to the oldest son, one would be given to the youngest son, to ensure that the oldest son would always have the position of preeminence as the head of the family. And the only way that could change is if the older brother died, and then the oldest son would step into that position and would also take on possession of all of his properties. But here's the problem. This happened when a man died, not while he's still alive. It would be a lot like having one of your kids say to you, hey, mom, hey, dad, basically what is your worth? You know, I mean, how many assets do you have? If we were to liquidate everything you had, how much do you think that would come to? And so, you know, you might figure it out and say, well, you know, we're worth this much money. And then the child would say, well, do I have to wait until you're dead to get my portion, or can I have it right now? How would you take that? Wouldn't you feel like, wait a minute, sounds to me like you're looking forward to my death? And essentially, that's what this son is saying. Father, as far as I'm concerned, you're dead to me. I want my portion now. I don't want to wait until you're dead. I want it now. This son is essentially saying, I am cutting my ties with you, Father. I don't want to be part of your family. I don't want to be part of your plans for my life. I don't want to be part of anything that has to do with everything that's part of that I have been given and I've been raised by. I want to do my own thing. I have a passion to do something, and I want my part now. Now, the most amazing thing in this story to me is that the father acquiesces to his son's wish. You see, the father would have been in his rights to simply say, well, here's your problem, son. I'm not dead, and you're just going to have to wait. In fact, the father in a situation like that would have been in his rights to say to him, you're getting nothing. No soup for you. You know, he could have said that right across the board, and that would have been the end of the story. You know, he could have been the inheritance Nazi and not given his son anything and said, your older brother will get everything. But it's kind of an amazing thing to think about it. And you have to understand, we talk about this concept of scandalizing the listener. Can you imagine what's going through the mind of these Jewish men who are sitting listening to this story, who themselves had sons and daughters who were waiting for their death to get their portion of the inheritance? And you can almost imagine their veins swelling in their neck, their faces getting red, the anger rising up in them and saying, who is this kid? Let us get our hands on him. We'll straighten him out. We'll straighten him in such a way that they'll never be able to put him back together again. And yet, instead of reasoning, reading that this father becomes outraged and angered and offended, he does it. He gives this son his portion of the inheritance, which tells me something about the father, that he is far more concerned with restoring his son than he is retaining riches. That in the eyes and the mind and the heart of this father, the value of the soul was more clear to him, that his soul was more important and of more value to him than all of the material resources he had. Which, you know, brings us to another question we'll answer and have to try to address in a moment. If this father is such a man, why does he have such a kid? How did a father like that produce a kid like this? And I know we live in an age where basically the mantra is there's no such thing as bad kids, just bad parents. But, you know, I think that overlooks some critical dynamics here. That, first of all, one of the concepts I want to disabuse you of is the idea that somehow you can raise sinlessly perfect kids. You know, this is a sinful world we live in, and you're a sinner, and you have a sin nature. In baseball, they call that three strikes and you're out. Your kid's going to be a sinner. I mean, it's something that's unavoidable. There is this sin nature. And some people say, well, it's, you know, it's either the result of nature or nurture. It's even either they picked up the predisposition from their ancestors or else it was the influence of their parents or both. But there is a third factor in behavior, and that's free will. It's choice. I can choose to follow God or disregard God. And one of the things I found very comforting for all parents is that there was a father once who was perfect. I know for a fact that he was the perfect father, and his kids disobeyed and turned against him. It's called God the Father, and Adam and Eve were his kids. And sometimes we underestimate the simple, profound power of sin to even pervert the behavior of kids who have no justifiable reason for having such behavior. But sometimes the allure and the temptation of sin can be great. Even in the life of people who know better, the allure becomes so attractive. And I want to talk in a moment about why I think that's there. But about this father again for a moment. There is some such wisdom in knowing when to hold tight, and there is wisdom in knowing when one should let go. You see, in dealing with, whether we're dealing with our parents or we're dealing with other people, there are some people who can only learn on their own. Now, Probably the most painless way to learn a lesson is to learn vicariously. In other words, you can look at somebody making really bad choices and reaping really painful consequences, and you can draw an intelligent conclusion. I don't want to do what they did because I saw what happened to them when they did what they did. And you can learn from that. And that's really the best way to learn. That's what the Bible is designed to help us with in one regard. Because when I look at the lives of the men and women that are displayed here, and I see them making good choices, and I see them making bad choices, and I can read those texts, and I can follow those stories, and I can draw a conclusion, I ain't going to do that. I mean, we see David committing adultery with Bathsheba, and he really pulled the wool over everybody else's eyes, didn't he? Here's the amazing thing about that story of David's adultery and murder of Uriah, is he got away with it. Nobody called him on it. Nobody knew what the truth was except for one snitch, God. God had to go blab it to one of his prophets who walks into David's presence and said, "Hey, David, I've got a situation I want you to deal with. There was this wealthy man who had great flocks, and his pastures went forever and ever, and he had a guest come to his house, and he was so selfish and so heartless that he went to his poor neighbor who all he had was a little lamb, and he took that lamb and he killed it and he roasted it and fed it to his guests. What should be done with a man that's so heartless?" And he said, "Well, that man deserved to die." He was indignant over such an injustice. And then Nathan the prophet said, "David, you are that man. You are that man." And suddenly David was exposed in his sin. You see, I read that story and I realize something. Galatians 6 says, "Sow to the flesh and you'll reap corruption." I mean, that's an inviolate law of the universe. In the same way that I know that if I drop something from a high place, it's going to hit the ground. It's never going to float up. Despite that Snicker bar commercial where the gal lets go of it and the Snicker bar floats up into the sky because it's so light and fluffy. I suggest that if you are impressed by that, you buy a Snicker bar, hold it out, let go of it, and see which direction it goes. You know, that's what bothers me. They're tricking us. It doesn't go up. It always goes down. And I know that it's going to go down even before I let go of it because I know that there's this inviolate law of the universe that says, things go down, not up. In the same way, we come to understand that if I transgress God's ways, there's a principle called the law of natural consequences that falls into play. And it's not like God says, "You blew it," and he pulls out a big stick and whacks your hand. No. God just simply said, "This is the principle of the universe. Transgress my ways, and this is what's going to happen." "Know for sure," he said in Numbers 32:23. "Know for sure this, that your sins will find you out." If that isn't a frightening proposition, I don't know what is. But he said, "Be certain of this. Even if you can hide it from all of the rest of the world, it's still going to find its ability to squeeze up to the surface of your life and suddenly expose you." That's a terrifying proposition. It's so terrifying that I've found that I'm always crying for the covering grace of Jesus Christ. "Wash and cleanse me from all of my unrighteousness, Lord, because I don't want to live in the exposure of my sinful nature. I want to live under the covering of your grace and of your mercy." But again, what's amazing to me, and somebody said this to me earlier in the week, and it just really has resonated with me, but they were talking about a situation, but I thought it's a perfect description of this father's response to his son. It went like this. When he was cut, he bled grace. When he was cut, he bled grace. This father was cut as harshly and as deeply and as painfully as a person could be cut. To be rejected and to be betrayed and to be used and abused by people that you love and you value, And instead of bleeding anger and rage and resentment and revenge and malice and bitterness and all the rest of those things, to bleed grace. That's divine. That's the moving of the Spirit of God. Which really causes me to wonder, if this father was such an incredibly godly and gracious man, why did his son rebel against him? Why did he do it? Well, let me offer some possibilities. The first thing we can't help but focus on is the allure of the world. There used to be a World War I, they had a song after the war, they sang, "How are you going to keep them on the farm once they've been to Paris?" You know, we had all these soldiers who came from the farms of the Midwest of America, and they shipped them over on ships, and suddenly they dropped them off in Paris, France, and these guys were dropped into the middle of the most enchanting playground for every kind of sensuality and pleasure they could imagine. And the bottom line this was in the popularity of the song was the fact that they recognized once they've had a taste of this lifestyle, they'll never be content to live back on the farm where nothing happens. It's kind of like, well, the closest I can relate it to was when they came out with color TVs, there was no way of going back to black and white. And I know there's about four of us in the room who can relate to that. Or let me put it this way, when I got HD TV, yeah. See, the problem facing many Jewish parents of that day was the fact that they lived in such proximity to the heathen world that was all around them. Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, is only 6 miles from the city of Sepphoris. Sepphoris was this grand, majestic city which was basically Greco-Roman in all of its culture. It had the theaters, and it had the arenas, and it had all of the things, the amphitheaters, and everything that was involved in the pleasure-seeking, the gymnasiums where they would work out and exercise in the nude, and all the things like that. The brothels were often right in the very center of the city. So they were full of all of the immorality and the impurities of that culture and the pleasure-seeking. And besides that, they had statues and images. And only a few miles down the road is this very humble little Jewish village where they're still drawing water out of wells in the ground. But in the big city, they have hot and cold running water. They've got great baths where they can go in and bathe and get massages and all this sort of stuff. They even have sit-down public toilets that you can sit on these just like we have today. And they have running water going under, and you sit down on them and you relieve yourself and you get up and it washes away and is carried outside of the city. I mean, this is an amazing. The Jews are going out with a shovel in hand, walking out over the hill, digging a hole, relieving themselves, burying the hole and going back. I mean, the contrast in lifestyle was so dramatic. And the first thing we think of is how do we keep our kids from desiring to cross the street? Because in the city of Bethsaida, where Peter and Andrew came from, was literally a sister city of the city of Julius, named after the daughter of Julius, Augustus, his daughter Julia. Literally, right across the street was that entire heathen culture. And the Romans did this on purpose to control the influence of the Jews. They just put cities right up next to some of their most prominent places just to keep the influence of Greek and Rome flowing into the Jewish community. Because they knew if they could get the Jews to buy into the culture, they eventually would become like them, and they would get rid of their distinctives. And so one of the first things you find as a parent that you struggle with is, how do I keep my kids from being shaped and molded by these things? And let me say that one of the things we do, and often unsuccessfully, is we try to cocoon them and isolate them so that they never become aware of what's out there. But the problem with that is many times, sometimes when we restrict something and we try to hide it, it creates a curiosity. And many times there's even an allure and an interest because we never really explain why it's evil and why it's wicked. Sometimes it's helpful to have kids ask you the question, why don't you want me listening to that kind of music? And so, and oftentimes we're just too distracted. I don't want to say you're lazy, but you may think that. But sometimes we're just too distracted to take the time to explain it to them, and instead we just simply say, just never mind, don't let me ever catch you listening to that kind of godless music and again. Well, can I get a tattoo? No! Why not? Because I said so. What I find is that's not real helpful. It's not real helpful. In fact, I found with my kids that we wouldn't let them play that music, so they just went next door and listened to it in the other kids next door's house. They heard it in their classmates. You know, you find that it's virtually impossible. I remember one time my oldest son Ben and I were watching a football game. He was a young teenager, and all of a sudden one of those commercials comes on selling your favorite adult beverage, and it's got these bouncing blonde bimbos, you know, and all this stuff, you know, and it's almost like the guy, all they had to do was pop the cap on the beer, and all of a sudden all these beautiful babes surround them and dancing and jiggling all over the place. And we're sitting there watching this, and I turned to Ben, I said, Ben, do you get the impression that they're trying to get us to believe that if we drink their beer, that we'll be swarmed by beautiful blonde bimbos from Sweden? And he goes, yeah. Well, it came on again, another version of the same thing. And I said, Ben, do you ever get the impression that they're trying to convince us that if we drink their beverage, that all we'll be surrounded by all these blonde, beautiful babes from Sweden? And he goes, okay. Well, it comes on again. And I said, son, do you ever get the impression? And he goes, okay, I get it. And I said, good, because I just didn't want you to miss that point, that it's a lie. I just didn't want you to miss. You see, instead of saying, don't look at that, cover your eyes, and don't get me wrong, there is an age where that's appropriate. But that's part of when you get into the place of learning when it's time to let go. To let go, to let them begin to make their own choices. That part of it is helping them to know why things are the way they are. Why it's bad, where it leads, what are the consequences, how does it affect your life, so that they are beginning to inculcate the very principles and values in their inner man. That's why it's so important when kids are growing up to teach them Bible stories. And let them see the consequences of bad choices and foolish decisions and impulsive responses and all the rest of it. And as they grow up looking at it, it begins to program into their mind that, you know, choices have consequences. Good choices have good consequences. Bad choices have bad consequences. But what you're trying to prepare them to be is not somebody who has never experienced or had to deal with the issues of life, but instead ones who have become so attuned to the critical issues and the ability to make judgments and decisions that when they're on their own and you're not there to protect them and you're not there to keep them from doing it, they can make that decision all on their own. But it doesn't answer the question, does it? So why did this guy make the wrong choice? Well, Solomon said in Proverbs 22:6, I know you know this one, train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Many of us have the idea, if I just do all the right things in raising my kids, he will grow up to be, or she will grow up to be a dutiful child, so I'll put them in Awanas, and I'll bring them to church every Sunday, and I'll have them memorize verses, and I'll do all these things. And don't get me wrong, I think that those things are good and fine and appropriate, but the problem is, that's probably not going to be the guarantee that we're looking for. Because I find in that statement a caveat, a couple of caveats that we need to note. Number one, the period between child and old is a long time. Train up a child, and when he's old, when he reaches maturity, and that's the key. Old there means maturity. I've known people who are old chronologically and still have not matured. And I've known people who are very young chronologically and are very mature. But there's always a gap. There's always that space. There's always that period where they have to decide is the God of my fathers going to also be my God? And sometimes they're going to choose to go down certain pathways that are going to grieve your heart. They're going to break your heart. And it's so important at those points, more than any other point, to be in prayer and be on your face before God and entreating the Lord that God will use whatever choices and decisions, whatever mistakes they make, that God will use those to open their eyes to understand why it is always best to walk with God. Because one of the things that Paul said about this, and this is really kind of a third criteria or a third issue here, is in Ephesians 4, 6, he says, "Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord." The Greek word is paraorizo. Orizo means, from the word orge, means anger. Literally, it means don't rouse them to wrath. Don't do things that provoke them, that irritate them intensely and infuriate them and bring anger to the surface. What are the things that make kids angry? Well, you hear it coming out of their mouths all the time when they say, "That's not fair." You see, what children really get exasperated over is when they see apparent inequities, injustices. As we get older, we just kind of get to the place, we get jaded and calloused, and we just go, "Well, life's not fair. You know, tough luck, life's not fair." But you see, when a child says that, what they're really saying is, "I don't feel like I'm loved, at least as much as somebody else is being loved." You know, one of the difficulties in parenting is that you just find that you naturally can relate to some kids more than other kids. I mean, that may sound like something terrible to say, but it's just a fact, a reality, that some kids' personalities are so much like your own, they're really easy to hang out with. Other kids have personalities that are so diametric to yours that, you know, it's a struggle. It's a struggle. You don't have to feel guilty about that. I'm confessing it now, and now you can feel free to confess it to God. But one of the things I've concluded about parenting that's critically important: no matter what things you see or don't see in your kids, the one thing that they want to feel from you more than anything else is that you actually enjoy them. That you enjoy them. That somehow you found in them something that's, you just, it brings pleasure to your heart when you're with them. And you enjoy them. Because I think if there's anything that's missing in the hearts and the minds and the lives of many kids, is they don't feel like their parents enjoy them because their parents don't spend any time with them. When you give them money and say, "Go away and do something," or when you always have a sitter there taking care of them or some other caregiver, and they're shuttled here and they're shuttled there, and you know, all the kinds of things that parents do because "I'm too busy and this is too important," and you know, we're always finding a reason not to spend time with them. Do you realize that the things that your kids want more than anything else is just to hang out with you? Now, if your kids are at that point where they've lived through 10 years of their life and you've never wanted to hang out with them, and now you're confused because they want to hang out with other people instead of you. But you see, that came as a consequence of having been pushed off and pushed off and pushed off and pushed off. Because the thing they want inherent, naturally is built into them, is they want to spend time with you. They want to hang with you. So that when we look at a son like this who's saying to his father, "I don't want anything to do with this family anymore," we're looking at someone who has concluded, "These people don't enjoy me." Now again, I'm looking at this and saying, how does this happen? Because I see this father is the most compassionate and loving thing. But the one hint that I have is that I think there was a dynamic going on between the older brother and the younger brother. And I say that maybe because I was a younger brother. And I understand this dynamic. That when my older brother used to always say to me, "You know, you were adopted." And in a very real sense, I mean, I grew up going through school, and because my brother got kudos for being good, I tried to get kudos by being bad. I didn't want to be my brother. You always have to be different than your sibling. And so he got, you know, high marks for doing his homework and behaving and being polite. And I decided I needed some significant marks too. And so I got significant marks for being rebellious, disobedient, loudmouth, smart aleck, you know, so forth and so on. I knew my closest companion going through grade school was the school principal. I mean, I knew Charlie Parlay better than anybody else, even his wife. I think I spent more time with him than his wife because that's where I was always being sent by the teacher. Get out of here and go down and see the principal. Okay, thank you. And fortunately, Charlie only threatened to punish us. He never did. We just would hang out and talk. Suddenly, I'm self-analyzing and I began to realize what my problems are. But it's important, I think, to understand that everyone has a certain degree of passion in their life. God creates us with a passion. And you may think that somebody is dull and uninteresting, but if you get into a topic that they really are passionate about, suddenly a transformation takes place in their life. You know, I'm not a very technical guy. I mean, I have to ask guys all the time, you know, who are technical to help me figure out how to make technical things work. But I've found that technical guys, I can kind of look at them and say, you guys, you really enjoy doing that? But you get them talking about how something works and suddenly their eyes begin to glow and they get excited and go, and they start going into all these details. And, you know, and if you're polite, you just nod, pretending like you have an idea of what they're talking about, even though you don't. But you realize that they have a passion. Every one of us has a capacity for incredibly intense passion. But the danger is if we allow that passion to take us in the wrong direction, we can become passionate for something as horribly self-destructive. But you see, naturally, we want to be passionate about our family, about this community that we're a part of, this support group. That's where our natural passion goes. But if we keep on trying to meet the needs of that internal passion and we find that they keep on being deflected, they keep on being pushed aside, they keep on being stopped and halted, eventually, we just give up and we follow anything that will say to us, I enjoy you. I think in some ways, when I look at this young man, I think what it comes down to is he was unwilling to accept the cards that life had dealt him. I can use that metaphor. You see, here, if we can kind of pull it all together, here's this young man who's in a family relationship where he's got a great dad who loves his older son and he loves his younger son, but somehow in that dynamic, the older brother, and I think this is proved by what we'll see when we get to talking about him further on, that the older brother, the term that's used in the scriptures is he lorded it over the younger brother. He knew that he was the heir. And in the Middle Eastern culture, it's an interesting dynamic. A friend of mine who was raised in a Middle Eastern family was the firstborn son. And there was only two children, him and his sister. And he said, and his sister was always having, as an adult, was having all sorts of personal problems. I mean, she's getting into drugs and alcohol and all sorts of unhealthy relationships and self-destructive behaviors and was suicidal. And I remember one time I was talking to him, saying, why is this? And he says, we have to understand what it's like in an Arab family. He says, I was the firstborn son, and I was the object of everybody's attention. A son was the greatest thing that an Arab father could have. And so that I was the center of my father's joy and the father's attention. He was always giving me gifts. He was always talking with me, spending time with me, traveling with me. But women are not important in that culture. And so my sister was always neglected. My father never showed her any affection, never spent any time with her, wasn't really interested. If she tried to get affection from him, he'd send her off to be with her mother in the kitchen to help out and do women's work. And he says, you know, I grew up with a strong sense of myself. And in his life, God had to kind of beat a lot of that out of him. It was a pretty painful process. But his sister on the other end had the same kind of inner passion. But like the country western song says, she was always looking for love in the wrong places. And that's where a lot of us are, and that's what I see happening in this young man's life. A passion that is unrequited in healthy relationships ends up seeking to meet its needs in any relationship without regard to whether it's healthy or not. This was a young man who had deep inner wounds, probably foisted on him by a harsh, oppressive, insensitive, and uncaring younger brother or older brother who saw him as only a future slave and subject to his will and his desires. And all of this I think I can validate when we get into looking in a couple of weeks at the older brother. And because of that, his passion welled up with such anger and frustration, was so unrequited in the healthy way that he finally was willing to throw away everything of value to see if he could find the love that he wanted on the other side of the fence. This world that he had been described to him as evil and dark and wicked, and you don't want to have anything to do with that, and yet he's sitting on this side of the fence and saying, if where I'm at is so good and so holy and so full of light, why am I so unhappy? Why don't I have any joy? Why don't I feel like I'm loved? Why don't I feel like I have a future? Why don't I feel valued? This place is so unfulfilling, I'm willing to cross the line to go someplace else and see. Maybe the fulfillment is on there. Maybe they've been lying to me all this time, and happiness is on the other side of the fence. I'm going there. And so he went. And I think his father, when he came to understand what was going on with his son, realized, if I'm ever going to have my son back, I have to let him go experience the thing that I wished he would never have to experience. But on another level, many of us are hearing our own personal story being told here. Maybe for the first time you're looking at your life and saying, you know, I think you begin to put the finger on why I have made the choices that I've made in my life and why I've ended up in the situations that I've ended up in. But there's a deeper level to this issue that I think is the critically important one if we're going to ever escape that cycle in our life. And it's the fact that what this son failed to realize was that God had a plan for his life. You see, so often we look at the external circumstances of our situation. We're kind of like Abraham who, you know, he's 90 years old. He still doesn't have a kid. And he knows that God has promised him a child, but he doesn't see anything happening. And he looks over at his bride and she's standing, you know, he sees her walking across a tent in her walker. And I mean, there's been no excitement in this relationship for a couple of decades. And he's going, you know, if I'm going to have an heir, it ain't coming through her. And so his wife offers a perfect solution. Take my handmaiden, go into her and raise up a child, and then you'll have an heir. And so he does. And after he gets done, he has this child, and God says to him some 13 years later, now I'm going to fulfill my promise to you. Here he is, 100 years old, and his wife's 90, and he's going, what does he say to the Lord? He said, Lord, accept Ishmael. I've got a son already. I've done it for you, God. You don't have to bother. I've got a son right here. And God says, no, you made that one. And you're going to regret that for a long time. I want to give you a son that's a son of the promise, not a work of your flesh. You see, where Abraham really got it wrong was He looked at the way things were at that moment and decided that he could foresee the future. As it is today, so it will be the rest of my life. Have you ever been guilty of that? Nothing's going to change. Everything keeps on going on the same way. I'm stuck in this same dead-end job. This marriage will never get any better. I'll never feel like I'm loved or valued. And, you know, these kids are just useless. There's no reason to even try to raise them anymore, you know. They may be 10, but they're on their own. And, you know, go out and get a job. And we come to the end of ourselves, and we want to just say, well, I'm just changing careers, or I'm changing communities, or I'm changing churches, or I'm changing spouses. And we do these things because we can't visualize in our mind that anything could be any different. And so we stop being, now this is going to sound strange, we stop being thankful for what we have. We stop being thankful for what we have. And we become that classic, you know, half glass kind of person. All we can focus on is what's missing. And we're so caught up in looking at what's missing that we don't even recognize what we have. We don't realize that sometimes the circumstances we're in are the plan that God has created for us to learn some things that are vitally going to be needed in your future. That the frustrations and discouragements and even the defeats and the failures that I experience right now are going to be key to me understanding what God's will for my life is sometime in the future. And only He knows what the future holds, and I do not know. That's why I think it's so amazing when Paul describes the reason why people fell into idolatry in Romans chapter 1. In verse 21, he says, because they neither glorified Him as God, nor were they thankful to Him. But instead, their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. They began to think wrong thoughts. Things like, God doesn't care. God doesn't answer prayer. Nothing is ever going to change. Nothing good is ever going to happen in my life. I'm never going to experience the love and the fulfillment that I want in my life. God's never going to be able to use me. And we begin to think these futile and foolish thoughts, and our mind begins to be darkened, and we begin to make stupid decisions. So how does God deal with that? Well, if we read on in the text, it says in verse 13, not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had, and he set off for a different, distant country and squandered his wealth in wild living. And after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, so who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. And he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Proverbs 27:6 says this, faithful are the wounds of a friend. And Psalm 119:67 says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I obey your voice. How does God correct us or change us when we have wrong thinking? Have you ever noticed how He lets you do the thing that you know you're not supposed to do? And then He lets you experience the consequences of your free will? You know, there are a lot of things, that bad things that happen in people's life, and they go, Lord, how could you let this happen? And God says, I didn't do this. You did this. You know, I've come to this interesting conclusion about my life. If it's good, it's Jesus. If it's bad, it was me. You know? But I find sometimes people are going around saying, well, if it's good, it's me, and if it's bad, that's Jesus. Lord, why are you doing this to me? I didn't tell you to go there. I didn't tell you to pursue that relationship. I didn't tell you to leave that church or join that group or, you know, I didn't tell you to do that stuff. That's all that you did on your own. And now you're unhappy because of the choices, and you want to blame me for the choice. The wounds of a friend are faithful. God in His faithfulness will take us through experiences that will teach us not only the wrongness of the path we're on, but the rightness of the path that we should choose. And so there's kind of a natural gravitational flow to all of this. I mean, there's really, I call it three phases to this young man's life. Phase one, wild living. It says he went wild living. The word there is osotos in Greek, literally means reckless, extravagant expenditure, chiefly for the gratification of one's sensual desires. It's really wrapped up in that hippie philosophy, it feels good, do it. Anything that's pleasurable, I'm going to pour myself into. That's a personal choice. You know, it's maturity that teaches you that not all things that are pleasurable are healthy. I mean, I deal with this on a regular basis. My wife has a drawer in our kitchen filled with candy that I am not supposed to touch. It's for the grandkids, not for me. We have a freezer full of Häagen-Dazs ice cream bars that I am not supposed to touch. And sometimes I do. Sometimes I sin against the greater power in our life. And every time I take my shirt off, she reminds me of why that was a bad decision. And I can look in the mirror and say, yep, bad choice. Bad choice. I mean, that's the way life is. It's a personal choice. But it's an interesting thing when somebody has been reared with all of the right information and yet they choose to ignore it for reasons that I've already tried to explain, and they do it anyway. One thing you can be sure of, and that's what I call phase two, there's going to be a change of circumstance sooner or later in their life. And I found that it's something about sinful pleasures. In the beginning, they are the best. They are the best. I mean, to be quite honest, you look at people who are abusing drugs and you see their lives being destroyed because of these addictions. But what you don't understand is the first time, it was incredible. That's the problem with drugs. That's the real problem. The first time is unbelievable. You've never known pleasure. You've never known sensual fulfillment. The first one is fantastic. The second one is okay. The third one, and you know, eventually it gets to the point where you just have to keep on increasing the dosage just so you can function. And it's no longer pleasurable. Now you're a slave of the thing and it owns you. But that's what we always miss about temptation. In the beginning, it almost always is incredibly pleasurable. And many times people stay hooked on things, not because it's pleasurable anymore, but they still have that memory of that first time when it was so incredibly good. But it begins to take a toll. There's an inevitability to the consequences of decisions, both good and bad. What does it tell us in the story? It says, well, suddenly he's in this place where the economy is booming, and then it says a severe famine came into that whole country. Suddenly the economy began to trash. The price of gasoline went to $4 a gallon. You know, the housing market collapsed. You know, I mean, things began to go downhill just like that. Things changed. And with it, his fortunes began to change as well. When Jesus said in Matthew 7, remember, he said, build your house in the rock. Because if you build in the sand, one day the waves will come and they'll hit that foundation of sand and wash it away and your house will collapse. It's interesting that we see this on a regular basis, don't we? It's one of the insanities of you know, somebody once said one of the greatest misnomers is government intelligence. Because one of the things we see our government do is people will build houses on places that have a history of being washed away by floods and by hurricanes and things of that nature. And the houses get wiped out, and then the government gives them money to go back and build a house again on that particular location. And what's crazy about it, we all know this. We know that it's only a matter of time before the consequences, the cycles of things will return, and that house will be destroyed, and we'll have to give them more money to go back and rebuild their house again on the same foundation. Over and over and over again. And we say, this is madness, yet I see people living their life that way all the time. But one of the things you can be guaranteed is, it's just a matter of time before natural consequences are going to catch up with your life. And when they do, it leads to the third phase, where it says, number one, he began to be in need. And his need became so great that the only job he could find, the only job for which he was now qualified, was to be a pig herder. Now, in a Jewish parlance, you couldn't get any lower than this. I don't know, have any of you ever raised pigs or lived on a pig farm? You know, these are not attractive animals, especially in large numbers. You know, I mean, I think that people who raise pigs should get some kind of award for laying down their life. Because they're smart, yes, but they're really predatorial. They're vicious creatures, and they'll eat anything. Literally. I mean, you dream it up in your mind, they'll eat it. Oregon State University, one time in their School of Agriculture, were feeding pigs processed sewage sludge to see what would happen. And what they did was, they ate it, they liked it, and they got fat. Now, I hope that they never turned into bacon, but you know, you never know. Interesting creatures. But to a Jew, you couldn't get, I mean, this is like, you have hit the bottom now. You're homeless on the street, you have no teeth, your hair's falling out. I mean, you are at the bottom, you know. You're going down to the lucky penny, you're selling your blood, you've hit the lowest point that you can. And then it says he got so bad that he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating. Now, these pods are carob pods. The carob tree grows all over Israel and the Middle East. And, you know, they're a long bean on a tree. They grow on these long kind of bean-like things, and they turn brown, and they have little seeds inside of them. And today we grind up the husk and mix it with, you know, certain sweeteners and stuff and make it as a dietary chocolate, you know, chocolate you can eat. If you have ever had carob chocolate in the stores, it's taken from these carob pods. But in biblical times, they didn't know that you could use it in that way. So what they did is they just simply gathered them and they fed them to pigs. Now, I sampled one time in Israel just to see what the attraction was, and I found there was none. The only thing is the carob seed, just a little point of interest, because since you don't have any place to go or anything to do, the carob seed was what they used to measure the weight of precious stones, especially diamonds, and that's where we get our term a carat weight. It comes from a carob seed. That was what they used in ancient times. Now it's probably a little more specific. But here he is eating the inedible. And then it says, but no one gave him anything. Now keep in mind, why did he leave his father? Because he yearned for the love that he didn't think he was getting. And now he's in a place where nobody, but nobody wants anything to do with him. And then it says in verse 17 that when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. The phrase, he came to his senses, is a Hebraism that is simply kind of a colloquial term that simply meant he began to see things the way they really were. You know, the fog begins to clear. His lenses become sharpened, and for the first time, he sees them the way they are. You know, it's like the difference between the way you look right now and now how you look. Tremendous improvement. Well, which one was better, actually? I may stick with this one for a while. But, you know, it's simply that this clarity suddenly comes to your mind, and suddenly you sit and realize what's going on. It's the very kind of clarity I experienced the moment I asked Christ into my heart. One of the things that was most profound thing in my life is in that instant of asking Christ into my heart as my Savior, suddenly I understood what was the purpose of my life. I mean, I understood that there was a God who loved me, that I was saved. It all made sense that I was a sinner, and that's where all my problems. I mean, it all came together without having a single class in theology. I understood instantaneously that something dramatic had changed my life. I had come to my senses. And because I had come to my senses, things began to change in my life. I wanted to find a Bible and I wanted to start reading it. I wanted to find a church and I wanted to start attending it. I wanted to hang out with people who had the same experience as me and spend time talking about that experience and learning from them and growing in that experience and living that out in my life. I mean, it just made sense to me. And ever since that moment, my life has made perfect sense to me. That I was created to know God and to worship God and to follow God and to serve God. And as long as that became my orientation in life, life has always made sense. Anytime I lose sight of that and that becomes blurry, then none of life begins to make sense and begin to wonder what the purpose of it is. But when you know the truth sets you free. And the first thing that we find him saying is, he realizes how gracious and good his father had been. He says, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. It's the kind of thing when David said in the Psalms, I would rather live be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord than to live in all the pleasure palaces of the wicked. And a man who doesn't know what it's like to be in the presence of God could never understand that. The doorkeeper was the lowliest, least regarded, least esteemed servant in the household. And he says, I would rather be in that, the most lowliest position in the presence of God than in the highest position in the presence of men. I think it was so interesting when Pat Robertson was discussing with some pastors about his question about should he run for president. And one of them said so insightfully, why would you want to take a lower position? And I think he was absolutely right. God had given you a place of influence within the culture for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Why would you want to give that up for an earthly crown? You see, when you come to this understanding, you realize that even the worst day with Jesus is better than the best day without him. You become thankful and grateful that he saved you. Those who have the worst in my father's house are so much better off than I am. The second thing he came clear to him was that the true source of his unhappiness was not the unfairness that he was chafing against. But he says, I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. He says, I realize that the whole reason my life was so messed up was I took my eyes off of the Lord. When David is caught in his sin, he says in Psalm 51, against thee alone, O Lord, have I sinned. And he wasn't denying his guilt with Uriah, his guilt with Bathsheba. But he says, I realized that where I went wrong wasn't that I saw this woman and lusted after her, but long before that ever happened, I took my eyes off you, Lord, and I began to look for things in this world to give me pleasure and satisfaction. That if I'd kept my eyes on Jesus, I never would have kept my eyes on Bathsheba. Lord, I sinned against you, and that's what led me to sin against my father. And the third thing he said, what he realized, that even though before when he left, he felt like he deserved so much, now he realized, I am so unworthy. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. Jesus would later say in chapter 17 of Luke that we should be like those servants who, after we've labored and toiled in the field all day, and we come home and we prepare the meal for our master. And he says, then does he say, you know, it's my turn to be served? No, he said, he'll say to his master, I am an unworthy servant. I've only done that which is my duty to do. You see, in our culture, this is almost heretical to say such things. We're so fed this diet of self-esteem and you deserve and, you know, all this kind of stuff that the idea that I would ever say, you know, Lord, whatever I receive from your hand is more than I desire just seems heretical. I mean, that's un-American. And yet it's something that you see in every man and woman who has been greatly used by God. They never considered themselves above whatever God had them doing in their life. They never esteemed themselves as too important to do small things. Because their identity was not found in what they had or what they did or who they knew. Their identity was found in their relationship with the Father. That they never outgrew the simple dynamic that I am here to live for God, to serve God, to worship God, to be whatever God wants me to be. And even that is more than I deserve. Even that is more than I deserve. And when you really believe that in your heart, you know what happens? You become thankful for everything that God has given you. Suddenly the glass becomes half full, not half empty. Gail Irwin once said to a group of pastors, and I love this because it's so true, he said, you know what? If you have one person in your church, that's one more than you deserve. So quit complaining to me about how empty your church is. I thought, that's the truth. If there's one person who will sit and listen to you pontificate on any topic, that's probably one more than should be there. But if you've got that one, rejoice and give thanks. But you see, the problem is sometimes we say, well, you know, I deserve better than this. Lord, I don't understand. I was destined to be rich and famous and beautiful. And I'm not even getting 1 out of 3. I'll let you pick which one you want. But, you know, somehow we have all these things built into our mind. We live in a generation that has been, especially the younger people who are growing up, have been fed this constant diet of you're special, you're wonderful, you, even though they never accomplish anything or do anything. And so they go into life thinking, hey, you know, first day on the job, I want to be president. You know? And then they don't understand why nobody's excited to have them there. But when we come to Christ, if we have that same attitude, then we find that we become an irritant in the body of Christ. And instead of serving wherever God puts us and building the body up, we go around demanding that we be recognized for how significant we are and how important we are in the greater plan of God. And we just don't understand why this bunch of spiritually numb people don't pick that up. Can't you see my gifts? And pretty soon we become critical, we become bitter, we become judgmental. We're irritated, we're angry. But we're not what God wants us to be. These three things were key, I think. The first thing he was overwhelmed with is his father's forgiveness. And we'll talk more about that. His father's response to him is off the charts. It makes absolutely no sense. And when that became coupled with the greatness of his sin, I mean, it only magnified how horribly he had behaved. In the light of the gracious compassion of his father towards him, it became so evident to him, I have been such a fool. I have sinned against heaven, and I've sinned against you. And I sinned against you because I first sinned against heaven. I didn't trust God for my future. I didn't trust God for what he was doing in my life. And I was angry and I became resentful and bitter and I ran away in an effort to try to change my destiny and all I did was destroy my life. But I've come to one critical revelation that even though I'm unworthy, my father was even compassionate to the lowliest servants in his house. And he made sure that even the lowliest servant in his house was fed and taken care of. And so I know that if I go back to my father's house, that he will show me that compassion and that grace. Because that's what I know about my father. That's the way he is. Father, we ask your forgiveness for our unthankfulness. We want to confess right now, Lord, that we complain about things that we shouldn't complain. Because, God, you're in the process of causing everything to work together for the good in my life, and I may be complaining about something that you're doing to bring about an end result that goes beyond anything I could ever imagine. And in a week or a month or a year from now, I'm going to be praising you for letting that happen in my life. So forgive me, Lord, for pretending like I have a clue what's going on. And I want to start right now thanking you, Lord, for the things you're taking me through right now today. And I want to confess to you, Lord, that I've sinned in my heart over and over again. I've sinned over and over again because I have tried to take control of my own life. I tried to run my own show. I didn't trust you to take care of me, and so I tried to take care of myself. And I've often, over and over again, Lord, made a terrible mess of things. I want you to forgive me, Lord. And I come to you, Lord, because I know what you're like. I've grown up watching your compassion, your kindness. And I know that you'll take care of me. I'm not worthy, Lord. Forgive me for thinking I deserved anything. just let me come home and live with you. We ask this of you, Father, in Jesus' holy name. Amen.